Hello and welcome to the flagship investment podcast for CFA Institute. Similar to the artist formerly known as Prince, with this episode we are now officially the podcast formerly known as Guiding Assets. Newly rebranded as the Enterprising Investor Podcast, we have the same focus on conversations with industry leaders, with me, your host Mike Wahlberg, but with a shiny new name that aligns with CFA Institute's established thought leadership blog, also called Enterprising Investor. So thanks for finding us, and not accidentally deleting us. Keep on listening and sharing because we have a great guest with us today. Joining me today from Barcelona, I have Barbara Stewart. Barbara is a CFA charter holder with more than 30 years of experience as an FX trader, high net worth manager, and in more recent years as a researcher, writer, and keynote speaker about women and finance. Each year, Barbara interviews scores of people around the world about their aspect of their relationship with money and publishes her annual Rich Thinking Study today on International Women's Day. We're going to ask her about the findings of this year's report, which asked 50 successful people, what's in your investment portfolio? Even more than the numbers, the study surfaced lots of interesting stories about how people from different backgrounds, regions, experience, and identities approach the investment question differently. Welcome back to the show, Barbara.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back, and I'm glad you changed the name to Enterprising Investor because I've been writing for this CFA blog for about 5 years now, so it lines really nicely.
That's right. That's right. And you have a new post that's landing today as well. It's talking a bit about this study that we're gonna talk about as well.
It's all very exciting. Thank you, Mike, for having me on the show.
No problem at all. So before we get to the results, a simple question just to set it up for you, Barbara. Can you talk a bit about the Rich Thinking series, who you interviewed this year, and what you were hoping to learn?
Well, every year I come up with some question and it just pops into my brain and it's always an open-ended question. This is year number 14 that's being published today. And essentially my goal every single year is to move the world of women and finance forward a little bit in whatever way I can. And it started out many, many years ago because I was irritated by the negative stereotypes about women and money. And things have changed dramatically, as everybody knows who's been following this space. So now I'm interviewing men as well as women. For the last couple of years, 25 smart men around the world, 25 smart women around the world. So I can see if there's any gender differences in the types of questions that I'm asking. And this year I came up with what's in your investment portfolio, mainly because I was personally curious, because the way that I've been investing has been terribly dull in exchange-traded funds. And a lot of what I read seems to indicate that the masses are in exchange-traded funds. So I thought, what would happen if I pick 50 kind of random people from a wide variety of industries and cultures and professions and interview them and see if they would share exactly what's current and in their personal investment portfolio. I have to say that this year was a little bit more difficult for me in terms of getting people to share on this question. I got rejected more than often because of compliance departments not wanting people, especially if they were in the finance industry, to be so vocal on this question. So perhaps that wasn't surprising, but it made my job a little bit tougher to get these 50 interviews in the bag this year. And I'm really happy with the outcome.
That's right. And you had half of your subjects were within finance and half outside of the industry as well, right?
Yeah, I did that deliberately to see if there was any difference with us in the finance world and whether we skew our portfolios a certain way or not.
So given it is International Women's Day today, did you find any discernible themes about how women in your cohort you were investing their money versus men, or and any other high-level takeaways?
I would say based on the data from the 50, which I don't know if that's statistically significant, but it is fairly random. So interesting, the data for that was by gender. Women had a higher component of traditional equities than men. 62% in stocks in women's investment portfolios versus just 41% in stocks for men. Men skewed higher on alternative investments, and that would be interesting to dig into. I don't necessarily know the reasons why for that.
Right, and then by region, you had some trends as well there around sort of how things are going down in the Americas versus Asia and elsewhere, right?
Yes, and the Americas had the highest equity component in their portfolios at 58% stocks, and Europe, Africa was an exact 50% in stocks, and Asia was lower at 42% in stocks. But Asia skewed way higher on, again, alternative investments and also cash balances.
Interesting. And then how about within that split of industry folks versus others? How did that work break down?
Well, I guess we all followed what we learned in the CFA because the finance types had 62% stocks in our portfolios versus the non-finance types at 43% stocks. But kind of more interesting to me was that the non-finance people seemed to be maybe more open-minded or something. They had a 25% higher allocation to alternative assets than the finance people. And they had double the allocation to both cash and real estate.
I wonder why that is. What do you think?
You know, I try not to put my own judgment on this information, but at a guess, you know, a lot of it comes down to marketing and who's receptive to marketing in our industry, right? So not to say that non-finance people aren't as smart as finance people, but we're probably, you know, more grounded in our studies because we've had to be, and maybe we're more skeptical when considering alternatives. Maybe we're a little bit late to the game, possibly, would be my guess. What do you think?
What do I think? I don't know. It's something that I'd love to dig into with you a little bit, because it's always interesting to kind of get behind the reasons for some of these things. And I had a few ideas here that I wanted to go through with you. One of them I found interesting was just this idea of sort of cultural or environmental nuances that can happen, because you have different marketplaces that'll behave differently. You have different structures that people are subject to, taxes and that kind of stuff. Did you see anything like that in there?
I definitely did. And I learned a lot through this process. One of the ones that might be a bit obvious to people is when I interviewed investors in Argentina and Brazil, for example, their portfolios always include inflation-linked bonds, probably for obvious reasons there. One thing I learned I didn't know about is a finance professional in Milan had his entire portfolio in Milan real estate because he said it's the lowest price per square meter of all of the world's big cities for real estate. Didn't know that. Singapore investors, a lot of them own commercial REITs, local commercial REITs, since they're comparatively low in risk and they're kind of like holding something that holds its value. And then one big surprise for me was in Mauritius, where I was about 5 years ago speaking to Mauritius CFA Society. Not much trading is done on the Mauritius Stock Exchange because it costs 1.25% on the buy side of a trade and 1.25% on the sell side of a trade for an all-in 2.5% per trade. So not many people in Mauritius are using that exchange.
Wow, we're in the wrong business, Barbara. We should be Mauritian traders, I'm telling you. Wow.
Exactly.
2.5 points on every trade. That's crazy. And that is interesting, because you mentioned about Argentina, Brazil, and I did get a chance to have a sort of a sneak peek at your report there. And I know that, you know, different areas around the world, and it makes sense to me, I guess, right? I mean, if that's what you know, and that's what your perspective on risk and return is, you've lived in a country like Argentina, Brazil. I know you had a South African respondent in there as well who had, you know, inflation-linked bonds or real estate and trying to find ways to hedge out that risk. I guess that makes a lot of sense. And I imagine that the rest of us in the world were probably wishing we had a little bit more inflation protection in our portfolios a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think so. And in those cultures, they, as you say, they just kind of grow up with that. And I think it's part of, you know, their upbringing as well.
Yeah, exactly. Any big surprises in the data?
Big surprises for me were some of the niche investment categories that I heard about. One guy, a consultant in Belgium, talked to me about how he sold his entire stock portfolio to buy a house in a forest outside of Brussels. And he said he and his wife decided they loved living in the forest so much that they bought all of the surrounding forest land. So they became obsessed with having a forest portfolio, so to speak, and nothing else. So kind of all in one thing. But he said that was their way of both investing in something that was going to make money, but also investing in themselves and their lifestyle. Another woman I thought was really interesting in Stockholm, who I'll be seeing next week when I release my report on March 8th, the founder of Lucy Global Fund. She started this fund a couple of years ago. It's a global equity fund with a main focus on companies in lifestyle, health, and beauty. So really kind of a very focused fund. And she did a great year last year. She's on 9 different platforms in Sweden. And she was up 17.3% just in those few sectors. So I found that really a kind of an interesting bet. And then another space that a couple of different people talked about was antique cars. So, for example, an economist I met with in Montreal said he owned 12 different exotic cars, and they're all over the map. And he owns the barn he bought to store all of these antique cars in. And he goes on all of these magazine trading forums and looks at all the prices of these different vehicles and is totally into it. And I even had another woman in Denmark who is involved in the same type of trading activity in antique cars. And then I guess the person that surprised me the most was the founder of Invest Vegan. And it is what it sounds like. This woman, who's the founder based in Utah, she said that in her view, veganism is a coherent ethical system that focuses on avoiding doing harm to living things. So essentially, the entire premise of her investment portfolio is asking the question, what harm is this company doing? And if the company is doing any harm to any living thing, they get excluded from the portfolio. And so there's a lot of companies that do good, obviously, that can get involved in investing, such as senior citizens' homes, anything that's helping seniors, or anything that's helping the world have a nice cultural enjoyment of life, such as a Duolingo or something like that.
Wow. Yeah, that takes investing in your values through your values to a whole new level of specialization. Hey,
exactly.
Yeah, one of the things I was surprised at is that there wasn't, because I feel like ETFs are, everybody wants to talk about ETFs these days. And we've had a few great chats on this show, even in the last 6 to 12 months, about active ETFs and ways that the folks are developing those, but not a ton of ETFs in there really this year. What do you think about that?
I was frankly shocked, because every year when I come up with my interview question, it's really just coming out of my brain arbitrarily, and I never know where it's going to go. So my fear was, of course, this is going to be the most boring research report of all time because everyone will have ETFs. No, not at all. So 50 very varied portfolios, ranging from all-in big bets like the Forestland guy to well-diversified portfolios by geography, industry, types of businesses. And then some people had radically conservative portfolios, just, you know, 100% cash or something like that. So it was everything in between. And I was frankly shocked that there were only a handful of people who had specifically ETF portfolios out of the 50.
Yeah, I find it interesting, this idea, because I know your universe often has entrepreneurs in it. I'm not sure how many on the non-finance side were, but I imagine probably a few.
A lot.
Yeah. So I feel like within that universe of professionals, there is a sort of a desire to concentrate bets. So did because working on something that you understand, you take a big swing at it. That's what you know from, you know, building and selling a business. So did you see much of that sort of correlation around big bets, correlation of risks among the respondents?
Definitely. I get referred to different people. I always call my research process the process of serendipity, because I kind of rely on the kindness of strangers and contacts with regard to who to speak with in various countries. And this year I ended up with quite a number of chief marketing officers, because one of the people that referred me to 5 or 6 people was a chief marketing officer, and he knew a bunch of them globally. So interestingly, chief marketing officers, of course, get involved deeply with various companies depending on what they're working on. And a number of these people were involved with fintech startups. So I see that they would take equity in the companies that they were dealing with as chief marketing officer. And then they would become, as you suggested, you know, they fall in love with the whole thing because they're so in it. And then they end up with 100% of their personal investment portfolio in fintech startups. And that's you know, it's no judgment, not necessarily a bad thing. And they're convinced that this is going to play out well. It's kind of like having their own venture capital portfolio. Some of them are going to hit it out of the park, perhaps. But I did see quite a few people in that space with 100% in fintech startups. Back to Mauritius, one of the finance executives I met with there, very senior guy at a Mauritius, big Mauritius bank, had 50% in one bank stock, a Mauritius bank. So wow. There you go, swinging from the fences on that one. You're employed there and all of your money's in there too, but very convinced that you need to take concentrated bets, and people get passionate, right? As we know.
Well, if those Mauritius banks own the investment dealers, then, you know, we know they're profitable, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And then I guess one of the downsides of having these big bets as well is you can end up with liquidity constraints as well, right? I mean, you talked about the fellow in Belgium with, I mean, I guess you get into that because you understood your own liquidity profile, and you can live with owning your home and owning all the timberland around you and cutting down trees when you need cash flow. But there was one story that stuck out to me, which was ways that you can get stuck with those liquidity constraints. The fellow in Kuwait.
Yeah, it's actually a woman finance professional that I met with in Kuwait. I didn't meet with her. I met with her over Zoom, rather. I've never been to Kuwait. She was talking about how she, you know, what's in her portfolio. She said she's looking around for all kinds of things to put in her portfolio. But right now, the only thing in her portfolio, she was stuck with a real estate fund that was focused on student housing in the UK. And she's unable to exit the fund. And she's waiting years and years for this fund to be liquidated, and a whole bunch of her money's tied up with it. And other than that, she has everything in one other stock, which is a Kuwaiti services company that produces consumer items like plastics and bags. But, you know, it's kind of funny talking to her. You could sort of see how that could happen. You could get all tied up in something. But, you know, interestingly, again, she's a finance professional, so we don't always see the non-finance people making the poor investment decisions.
Yeah, well, hopefully that works out for her. I guess the downside, or the flip side rather, to concentrating your bets this way is, you know, if it doesn't work out. So any horror stories from your sample?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've lived through my own horror stories, as have we all, I'm sure, over the years. So you can always feel empathy for people. But a couple of examples. One guy I spoke with who's based in India, in Bangalore, he was a chartered accountant and he got bored with his job and he is now a part-time stand-up comedian. So that was kind of an interesting mix of a career. He told me how in 2007, he invested all his personal savings into a mutual fund portfolio. And it was the first time he'd really become a serious investor. And he made 40% in 1 year. And he said that was just such a beautiful thing. And then, of course, the year after, he lost exactly the same amount, 40%, with the same portfolio because 2008 hit. And so he said he just got totally spooked and cashed everything in. And he's been 100% in cash ever since that time. So that's a long time to be sitting in cash. But he just got rubbed the wrong way by a mutual fund portfolio.
That story of chasing performance is unfortunately so all too familiar, hey, especially for retail investors.
Oh, I know. And that's such a graphic example of obviously what can happen in such a short period of time and how it can affect people. Another woman I talked to in Philadelphia, a retired dentist, told me a kind of funny story that when she was in graduate school for dentistry, an investment group came to their campus and gave a presentation on options. And she knew nothing about options, but she had saved a few thousand dollars by that point. And she decided, oh, what the heck, this sounds good and all my colleagues are doing it. So she invested her money in coffee options and doubled her money. But then she didn't hesitate after that to reinvest everything she'd gained, plus the original amount she'd invested, and she put it all into rubber options and promptly lost all her money. So she decided now she's a boring, diversified portfolio type of investor.
Having Orange County flashbacks there.
Just,
remember when they went bankrupt many years ago? Yeah, that was...
I was there for that story. Yeah.
So at my asset management firm, we were talking recently with an outside planner who does something called investment therapy, with her clients. And it made me think of you. One of the first things that she does is have her client take her through the history of their relationship with money. So whether that's good, bad, whatever, in order for her to understand, among other things, how they might perceive risk. So this this person who had, you know, lost all their money and then went to cash would be, you know, when he came to, or she came to this investment therapist, they'd be all cash. So it made me think of this study as I imagine your subject's money stories likely informed how they ended up where they are now. So can you speak to that?
That's it. And I mean, I'm not a financial therapist, but I sure feel like it, like we all do as an investment advisors. You're listening to people tell you their deep, dark secrets a lot of the time. And it occurred to me after I'd done these 50 interviews that, you know, if we have a prospective client, for example, and we're seeing their existing investment portfolio, and we often take a look at these and go, oh my God, like, how did they come up with this portfolio? It occurred to me that, you know, rather than trying to just go right ahead and fix their portfolio like we're trained to do, maybe we should spend some time talking to them about why it's like that in the first place, because it possibly could reveal some really useful information about what's important to that prospect and how they may have worked with their previous advisor, which might save us some agony as well. So I think this context is kind of like know your client, but know your prospect could be really valuable, because if you get to the root of why their portfolio, the one they have brought to you, looks the way it does, and how they came up with that existing strategy, why did they build it the way that, you might get into some of those background stories about horrible upbringings or being ashamed of money or all of those financial therapy things. And so this, you know, to me, I realized it leads into our investment policy statement section, unique preferences. We think about excluding sin stocks or tobacco stocks, but there are other unique preferences in why people may need psychologically to invest in one way versus another. And obviously that's critical for us as advisors to understand that.
Yeah. So with that understanding, then you're probably going to, you know, have a better relationship with your client. Your client will trust you more, which is obviously very important. Obviously, I imagine have a higher conversion rate as well for your efforts there. So yeah, it's good thinking. And it made me think back as well to this idea of, you know, the financial professionals versus the non-financial professionals. And at the end of the day, we're all human, and we're a result of everything that came before us. It made me think as well about Morgan Housel's book, Psychology of Money, where he talks in there about how there's theoretical best practices for how you should set up your portfolio, you know. And then he said, well, for me, that I sort of threw a lot of that out the window. I carry far more cash than I should, than the experts all tell me I should. I paid off my house during that long period of low interest rate environment, because he had to create an investment portfolio that worked for him. So that was really intuitive for me.
Exactly. It reminds me of one of my interviews with a woman in Taiwan. She talked to me about how in high school, she was given an allowance because she had to go away to school and her parents would send her money, but it was all for food. And she lived right beside a concert hall, and she loved going to concerts and was really into it. So she spent a lot of that food money on concert. And one day she had to have a reckoning over the phone with her mother about why that money had gone away so quickly. She had to ask for more money. And she was really shamed in that phone call, and she never forgot it, that she felt like she never wanted to have to ask anyone for money ever again. And so even though she's had a long career in the investment industry as a hedge fund manager, her personal portfolio is always 50% in cash and 50% in startups and other investments, because she just can't ever run the risk of not having that cash in the, you know, under the mattress.
Well, we're coming to the end of our conversation this year. Unfortunately, Barbara, I'm going to guide you back to our standard question, which is, what was your first job in the industry? And if you could go back and take yourself for coffee on your first day, what key piece of advice would you offer yourself?
My first job in the industry, after 47 interviews of trying to get into a trading room from being a Xerox salesperson, my first job was FX salesperson for Bank of Montreal Nesbitt back in 1991. And I was terrified because I did not have any experience. And they, in fact, hired me for my ability to sell with my Xerox background. And I didn't really know what interest rates were, and I wasn't properly trained, but they hired me as a guinea pig, and it all worked out. But if I could go back, I would say, you know, you don't have to cry every single night. It will be fine.
I've been speaking today with Barbara Stewart, CFA, author of the Rich Thinking series, including this year's edition titled What's in Your Investment Portfolio. You can find more about the report in a blog post published today on the Enterprising Investor blog, as I mentioned before. So please check that out. Thanks for coming on the show today. Enjoy Barcelona. I can hear the sirens out there. Stay safe. It's a wonderful city. I look forward to chatting with you next time.
Big city life. Thanks so much, Mike.
I'm Mike Wahlberg, and this has been the Enterprising Investor Podcast.